Good afternoon, everyone.
Good afternoon.
My name is Kim G, and I come from South Jersey, so thank you so much for inviting me up here. I am a recovered compulsive overeater. I know we did talk a little bit about that, Barbara did, and I just want to say why I say I'm recovered today, and it's because it is of God. I'm going to talk a little bit about my journey in OA, and when I identified myself as recovering, it was all about Kim, all about what Kim could do to try to lose weight, all about what Kim could do to try to stay abstinent. When I walked through these steps and had a spiritual awakening, I became recovered because God removed the obsession. That today, I do not think about food. I do not want my binge food. That's the miracle that the 12 steps offers us. And that's why I identify self as recovered. To me, it's almost falsely humble to not say it, because then I'm not giving God his due. Recovering is of me. And I'll talk a little bit about what those results were when I was trying to recover in and of myself. So I've been in OA now for 20 years, and the first 17 years that I did it, I really disrespected the program. I really treated it like a diet club. It was dieting with group support. And it was basically just temporary respites. You know, times in the food, times out of the food. Times in the food, times out of the food. A good year in Overeaters Anonymous meant that I was abstinent more than I was not abstinent that year. And the last I had 6 years of abstinence, got really skinny, just, you know, physically. My top weight was a size 24, where in my early 20s I was living with my parents, and when I did laundry, I had to take breaks going up and down the stairs because I would get so out of breath, and my doctor wanted to put me on high blood pressure medication. In the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous, I dieted down to a size 2 where my menstrual cycle stopped, and I started to have my hair started to fall out. And then interimly, I was at the size I am now, which is a 10, but I was binging and purging and over-exercising. And remember one time specifically that I actually passed out on an elliptical and had slipped my head open and got up trying to cover the blood because I hadn't done my penance yet to earn back the binge that I had just done earlier that day. So for years in Overeaters Anonymous, I thought food and weight was my problem. How many people here think food and weight is their problem? Okay, if that's true, then why, when I was abstinent, didn't everything be okay? How come I could get abstinent hundreds of times and still pick up again? And if weight was my problem, how come the dozens of times I would get to goal weight, I would pick up again? So it couldn't be that food and weight was my problem. So the last 5 years before I really found this big book, me and my sponsor had a brilliant idea. If you change the definition of abstinence, you can stay abstinent. So I proceeded to put on 50 pounds, my sponsor proceeded to put on 100 pounds, and we stayed in the rooms telling everybody that we were abstinent. And then 4 years ago, in one of the storms we had in New Jersey, my little Jack Russell zigged and I zagged, and I looked down as I fell, and my foot was facing 150 degrees the wrong way. And luckily, your guy, you know, this huge storm and one car happened to come by and he stopped and he called 911 and I was taken to the hospital. And I discovered, I'm trying to think of which way to do this. I discovered my powerlessness at that point. You know, we always hear about our bottom. Well, the bottom worked against me because what I would do is just hit a different red line and then they give me license to more eat. Well, my bottom is when I graduate high school. My bottom is when I turn 21. My bottom is 200 pounds. My bottom is a size 20. And then every time I hit that red line, I would just change the red line. So what happened to me 4 years ago in January, this coming January, was that I hit a spiritual bottom. I was spiritually bankrupt. And I was more terrified than I ever was in my life. And I had to admit that I had been in relapse for 5 years. And I had no ability to go to meetings. I was bedbound. And I found a phone meeting that went through this big book, paragraph by paragraph. And for the first time in my life, I knew what I suffered from. And when I knew what I suffered from, I suddenly was able to submit to the 12 steps in a way I never did before. Because the 12 steps for me during those 17 years when I was recovering, because Kim was doing it, was the steps were just a really interesting psychological exercise of how I could blame my mother for all my problems. And the steps were something that you didn't need to particularly take in order, only when you felt like doing them. So what I did was, when my program was, as Barbara was saying, meeting makers make it. If my program is based on 90 meetings in 90 days, that means on day 91 I'm going to eat. If my meeting is based on my sponsor, because that's what I was told, you get the best sponsor, you're going to stay abstinent, then if I can't get in touch with my sponsor, I'm going to pick up. If my program is based on phone calls and nobody picks up, then I'm going to pick up. So the tools are there to support us as we work the 12 steps. The tools in and of themselves as a program of recovery will not work for the real compulsive overeater, because I need a spiritual solution to my problem. So that was a big part of the recovering, is I use these outside things in order to try to cure a spiritual problem. And unfortunately, a lot of meetings support that philosophy. Because I would come back from relapse and they would say, what happened? Oh, you're not going to enough meetings. Okay, I follow directions. I would go to more meetings and then I would pick up. And then I'd come back and they'd say, well, what happened? And I would tell them, say, oh, you're not making enough phone calls. And I would do more phone calls and I would still pick up. The problem is you don't have the right sponsor. And I would change sponsors according to what they would tell me, because I needed someone to back me up on my bullshit. And if you weren't going to back me up on my bullshit, I would want nothing to do with you. So my personal experience, this is just my personal experience, was the combination of a very muddled message in the room and me looking for every freaking loophole I could find allowed me to stay in the rooms for 17 years using it as a diet club and suffering and going deeper and deeper into the actual disease, which is being a compulsive overeater. So I break my ankle in January. And what had happened was my outer bone in my ankle, or the fibula tibia, I don't know what they're called, broke in half, and every muscle and ligament in my leg had been ripped. And I went to that doctor, I was supposed to get surgery in 3 days, and they took x-rays, and they said, oh, you're getting surgery tomorrow. And I had surgery, and, you know, was put in a cast, and the doctor told me it was going to take me 12 months to get better. And I was like, okay. And every time I went to the doctor after 1 month, why aren't I better? And he would go, because I told you it's going to take 12 months. And I would go 2 months later, why aren't I better? And he goes, because I told you it's going to take a year. And how many of us, in a way, go, I did the first step, why aren't I better? Because there's 12 steps. And you get to step 3, why aren't I better? I don't know how many of you, but I've worked the OA waltz many, many years. Steps 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And I would scream, why aren't I better? Because there's 12 steps. And once I got my leg casted, and when they took that cast off, I mean, my leg would move like this. That's all it would move. And I was sent to physical therapy 3 times a week. And I would go there, and they would give me homework, and I would do that at home. And I remember coming back to physical therapy one time, and I said, well, you know, so it was the same people I saw. I said, why aren't they getting better? He said, well, Kim, it's obvious you're doing your homework at home. It's obvious that they're not. And they told me that I was going to have to be willing to be in a lot of pain. Because what had happened with 6 weeks in a cast, all my muscles contracted. And I was going to have to be willing to rip those muscles in order to get that flexibility back into my ankle. And I was willing to do that because my doctor told me that I would not be able to walk again if I didn't do it. And he also told me I only had 1 year to get better, because whatever I didn't gain back after a year, I was never going to get back again. Well, when you come into OA, now, if I had said to the doctor, you know what, I don't want to have that surgery, I think I just want to do the physical therapy. And I had seven screws and like a plate in my ankle. I couldn't do physical therapy on a snap bone. Yet what I did, so he told me that was first and foremost. My other problem my 17 years before was I thought I had the option to work the steps to get abstinent, or I could get abstinent and work the steps. I don't have that option. I don't have the clarity of mind to work the steps unless I get abstinent first. I didn't have the option to say, I don't want to have the surgery right now, I just want to do physical therapy. First and foremost, I had to get that bone stabilized. And then once that bone was stabilized, I could now work on the other stuff. Going through the steps is not comfortable. I had to be willing to go through the uncomfortability of walking through these steps so I could get my life back. The same way I had to work on the, be willing to go through that pain of the physical therapy in order to get my flexibility in my ankle back. One of the other things I did is I tried to go to meetings only And I never did anything outside of the meetings. What I would do is live till the, in restlessness, irritability, discontentment until the next meeting where I could get some relief. And that's not going to get better. To go to physical therapy and not do the exercise in between, I wasn't going to get the flexibility back I needed in that ankle. And even today, I walk without a limp, but these are the cutest boots I own, just so you know, because I can't wear heels anymore. My foot does not flex a certain way, and I've had to accept the fact, and I had to give away all my cute shoes. I have to accept the fact that I am a compulsive overeater, and there's certain things I cannot do. But the things that I can do are amazing. And I have to accept the fact that if I don't keep my ankle supple, it's going to start to get stiff again, and it's going to start to hurt me. And I have to accept the fact that I have to live in 10, 11, and 12, otherwise that mental obsession will come back. Because as absolutely convinced I am that I am recovered today, that I do not want my binge foods, I am equally convinced that in and of myself, if I stop doing this work, that mental twist will come back and I will eat again. Because from the core of my soul, I understand that I'm a compulsive overeater, but I also understand today, because of these 12 steps, I do not suffer from compulsive overeating. And there's a big difference in that. So when they told me to talk about what works for me, what really worked for me, what was different when I 4 years ago, it was for the first time I knew what I suffered from. And since today is the International Day of Experiencing Abstinence, I thought I'd talk about what abstinence is. Because one of my big confusions was I thought abstinence was a food plan. So what I would do is just keep switching food plans, whichever one was the flavor of the week. And they're two different things. Abstinence is refraining, and I meant to write down the World Service definition and I forgot. But abstinence is refraining from those foods and those food behaviors that create the phenomenon of craving. That's black and white. Abstinence is black and white. You're either abstinent or you're not. Your food plan is those limits and boundaries around the foods that you do eat. And that is going to change. And that is different for all of us. Someone who's 5'10" is not going to eat the same thing as someone who's 5'1". I just found out that I'm postmenopausal, so I might have to change my food plan. If you go from a night job to a day job, if you're pregnant, if you go from training for a marathon to working in front of a computer for 12 hours, your food plan will change over your lifetime. But your abstinence will not, because it's a biological manifestation of an allergy that does not change over time. I personally am allergic to penicillin. I had a really bad reaction when I was an infant. I am not under the false idea that if I take penicillin today at 47, that somehow I'm not going to be allergic to penicillin. And in fact, I'm convinced that probably the allergy will be 10 times worse because my body's older, my metabolism's slower. And I believe that too. My personal belief is that if I pick up, I'm not going to go back to where I was 4 years ago. I'm going to go back as if I'd eaten the 4 years. It's going to be that much worse. So I'm going to go and jump right into the doctor's opinion and look at what is it telling us that abstinence is. So the chapter that really hit me, that really took away a lot of the guilt and shame, is on 28, Roman numeral 28, where it says, "We believe, and so suggested a few years ago, that the action of alcohol on these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker." So when we think of allergy today, we're thinking of a cough, runny eyes, a hive, something like that. Back in the 1930s, it was a much simpler definition. It just means an abnormal reaction to a substance. So I am not an alcoholic. So if I sit down to an alcoholic and we each have 5 shots of tequila, we're both going to get drunk, because that is the normal action of alcohol on a body. What's going to happen to me is I'm going to feel a little bit sick, I'm going to feel a little bit nauseous, tipsy, out of control. I don't like that feeling. I do not want any more alcohol. The alcoholic is going to get charged up, excited, exaggerated, wonderful feeling, and they're not only going to want to drink the rest of my tequila, they're going to go out searching more tequila. So if 8 out of 10 people react like me, and 2 out of 10 people react like the alcoholic, it simply means they have an abnormal reaction. So that took all the guilt and the shame out of the fact that I have this allergy. Now, what I didn't realize at the time is when I would go to a birthday party and somebody would have a half a piece of cake, and I would sit there beating myself up because why don't I have that willpower? They don't have willpower. You know what's probably happening to them? They're having the half a piece of cake, they're enjoying it, and suddenly it's a little too rich. It's a little too sweet. They're feeling a little bit stomach aches. They don't like that feeling and they're stopping. They don't have willpower. They don't want any more cake. That made sense to me. And that made sense to me why people would say to me, Kim, push yourself away from the table. Just eat half. Because what they did is they looked at me. They looked said, looks on what the food was doing to me and said, why are you doing it? And I was looking at them, knowing what the food did for me and wondering why they weren't doing it. So I had to get clear on what foods I had that allergic reaction to. I can tell you, I can make love to a peanut butter ice cream sundae. I've never felt that attachment to Brussels sprouts. So we know there's certain foods that give us that exaggerated reaction. We have to know what they are. And often we have to look at them as ingredients, because this is where I would get tripped up too. I know Snickers bar, I'm going to go to town on. But I just had a really good workout in the elliptical machine. I'm going to have a power bar so I can have some power. If you take those ingredients in a power bar and the ingredients in a Snickers bar, they're the same ingredients. One just doesn't taste as good. So we have to look and we have to do some investigation. An alcoholic walks into an AA meeting, they know alcohol is alcohol is alcohol. We as compulsive overeaters have to do a little bit more investigation. But once that investigation is done, we have to fully accept, fully concede that those foods we can never, ever participate in again. Those behaviors we can never, ever participate in again. So how does this work? So let's say that was just my problem. All I have is the allergy. I mean, I've had conversations with friends that tell me, I can't stop eating Doritos once I open up a bag. And I say to them, well, what do? I don't open up the bag. That's a really good solution if you're not a compulsive overeater. Why is that? Because we have a twofold illness. We have an allergy to the body, which we just described, but we also have this mental obsession. We have this brain that locks in on the idea is the only way that I'm going to get comfortable is by picking up the food. Okay, so we're going to look at that interaction. The paragraph at the bottom talks about first the allergy and then the obsession. It says men and women drink essentially because they like the effect produced by alcohol. So I'm getting an effect from that. So if I think I just like the taste of Oreos, then I just need to not eat the Oreos. But why did I eat Oreos that were on the ground that had ants on them? Why would I burn something and I would still eat it? Why would I eat something raw? Why would something be stale and I would eat it again? It can't be just that I like the taste of it. I'm chasing an effect. And I always think to myself, when I was in college, we had woods behind us at my parents' house, and they were building condos. So for a couple years, we were inundated with mice, just tons and tons of mice. And so the night before I start college, I'm terrified. And I always, how does one handle being terrified? Eat. So 2 o'clock in the morning, I get up and I have cereal. And I go into the pantry and I put my hand in the pantry and a mouse jumps on my arm, runs down my back and goes across the kitchen table, down the floor. Do you think I didn't have my cereal? No, of course I had my cereal. I needed ease and comfort. So the next year, before my sophomore year, same thing. I'm terrified. 2 o'clock in the morning, I go downstairs. I get this cereal out of the pantry. I'm sitting at the table, crunching on it, so scared, and I hear this rustling noise. And all of a sudden, a mouse runs out of the box of cereal, across the kitchen table, across the floor. Do you think I stopped eating the cereal? Maybe those chocolate chips were not chocolate chips in the cereal? I don't think I like the taste of cereal that much. I'm chasing an effect. Check your own history. It's an effect that we're chasing. And it says here that it is elusive. And it is. It kind of can be confusing. But I always use the simple equation. Since I've been hit puberty, you put me in a room of 50 guys, blonde hair, blue-eyed, I'm going to be zoning in on them. I don't remember making a decision about that as a kid. I don't understand why that is, but I understand that's true. I might know a guy with brown hair and brown eyes is good looking, but my mind's gonna go directly to the blue eyes. That's the exact same thing. I've never gotten up in the middle of one of the hurricanes that we've had over the years and thought, my God, I'm out of broccoli. Oh my God, I gotta get some broccoli, But I have made sure, because what if the power goes out? You better have some non-perishable items like M&Ms to get you through a hurricane. even though I think broccoli's non-perishable, but the M&Ms are a lot better. So I'm definitely chasing this effect, okay? My alcoholic life is the only normal one. I cannot differentiate the true from the false, and I start to think about my decisions. When I babysat in high school, I didn't pick it according to the kids. I would check out their pantry on the first job, and if the pantry was good enough, I was there again. You know, I talk about the weddings I attended in my 20s. I can tell you who had the best buffets and who had those chocolate mountains with the strawberries going on it. I can't tell you who the heck was in the wedding party. In fact, I was at a wedding last week, and I was so struck. It's a cousin I've never even, cousin's kid I've never met. He's 30 years old. It was all his college friends were there, and they were having a good time. I don't remember college. I really don't. I remember the cafeteria. I remember scheduling my classes around mealtime so that I could have the excuse of going to the cafeteria and bringing the food to my bedroom by itself. I remember my roommate who was really thin, her dad would buy her Entenmann's, and I would eat all the Entenmann's, and then she would say, I don't understand why I'm not putting on weight. Look at all the Entenmann's I'm eating. And I'm like, I don't know why either, Tricia. Entenmann's are gone. You must have eaten them. You know, so I don't even remember. I don't have a single friend from college because the only relationship I had in college was with the food. So once again, if that was my only problem, then when I put the food down, my problems go away, right? What this is going to tell us now is what happens when I'm not eating. It says they are restless, irritable, and discontented unless they can again get the sense of ease and comfort which comes at once by taking a few drinks. My real problem is abstinence. I can't get comfortable abstinent. And the only solution I've ever found to abstinence is to picking up the food. So I don't come to Overeaters Anonymous because I have an allergy of the body. I come to Overeaters Anonymous because I have an obsession of the mind that needs the treatment of the 12 steps. And that was my big problem for many years in Overeaters Anonymous. I tried to treat a twofold illness with a one-fold solution of abstinence only. And there's bedevilments in this book on page 52 about the feeling of uselessness, not being in control of our emotional natures. And someone had me read that and say after each sentence, when abstinent. And if those bedevilments didn't go away when I was abstinent, then I had a bigger problem than just having to get abstinent. And my personal experience was that the bedevilments were worse when I was abstinent because I didn't have the buffer of the food anymore. Food was my solution for many, many years. It took the pain away. It took the loneliness away. It took the joy away because joy was painful because I knew the pain was right behind it, and feeling joy scared me because then the pain was going to feel that much worse. So I needed to find a way to be comfortable abstinent. So what does that look like when it's together? It talks here, after they have succumbed to the desire again, as so many do, the phenomenon of craving develops. So succumb means to submit, to surrender to a superior power. That's what happens when we pick up. You know, one of the disservices I know I did in OA and I see in OA is we talk about slips and we talk about being sloppy with our food as an excuse to say because we don't want to stop counting our days. And if I classify it as a slip, then I don't have to get up in front of a room and say I have 90 days and whoops, now I have not one day. So what does succumb mean? You know, I remember two examples I think of. A girl called me and told me that she had a slip, but she talked to her sponsor. We have to be honest about how we're working with people. And her sponsor told her not to worry about it. It's just a slip and keep moving. And that doesn't have to change her abstinence state. And I said, well, what happened? What's a slip? And she was out to dinner with her family at a restaurant and ordered dessert. So I said, okay, so a slip, which I did when I fell, was standing 1 second, on the ground the other. She defined a slip as sitting in a restaurant, asking a waiter for a menu, deciding what to order, waiting till he came back, giving him her order, waiting the couple minutes for the waiter to come back, picking up a fork and eating the dessert. That's not a slip. That's succumbing to the desire again. And if we don't get clear on that in Overeaters Anonymous, we're going to die as a fellowship. The other one, a girl called me and she said she had a slip. And she said, well, you know, I don't eat flour products in general. And I was really hungry on my way home, so I had a whole wheat grain muffin. But since it was whole grain, I'm just going to consider it a slip. Do we have any alcoholics in here? Okay, so if I was your sponsee, Oh, well, still, let's say I was in your meeting. And I said, I just need to tell him myself. I'm a gin and tonic girl. On the way home, my office had a party, but I just had a couple light beers. So I'm going to consider myself sober because I'm a gin and tonic girl. That's what we're saying when we say that. You know, I can't eat ice cream. It doesn't matter if Amish people in Lancaster, Pennsylvania have cows that eat organic crud or curd or whatever it is, and that's what the milk is made out of. It's still not abstinent. So we have to once again get clear on what our food is. Another big word I keep hearing, I don't eat recreational sugar. And I'm thinking, what? Do you go out to recess with the sugar? What the hell does that mean? Because they don't eat desserts. But they eat, all the food they're eating is absolutely filled with sugar. You know, so we have to know individually what we our binge foods are, because me giving you my food plan and my binge foods, all the foods I eat and don't eat would be very nutritionally sound for you. But if you are eating foods that I can eat that you can't eat, you're going to die in this disease. So we have to make sure that we each support each other in discovering what each of our binge foods are, and then abstaining from those binge foods 100%. You know, the line here on page XXX, it says the only relief we have to suggest is entire abstinence. That's where our founder, Roseanne, got the word abstinence from. After a few years in OA, and she realized everybody was just counting calories and was crazy, she knew there was something that was missing, and she was going to AA meetings, and she heard this line, and she goes, you know, we have to know what we're abstaining from. How can we work these steps if we don't know what we're abstaining from? So the big book is going to say over and over again that first we have to get abstinent. Now, I remember a TV show I saw years ago, and it was a bunch of people, and they were filming them, and they had an open bar, and they were all drinking, and they suddenly stopped and said, okay, who thinks they're okay to drive? And all these people raised their hand, and then they had them blow, you know, that thing. And people were shocked to find out that some of them were twice the legal limit. And they were like, oh my God, I had no idea. They were horrified. That's what I have to recognize with me. If I am still on my food, I'm impaired. I don't have the clarity of mind. I don't have the ability to work these steps, which I need to live. I need to survive unless I'm 100% abstinent. And for us to support each other in any other message is hurting the fellowship as a whole. So we have to get real clear on that. So since I have... looks like I have 5 minutes left. I'm going to go into something else, because first I have to know who I am, and this is who I am, but I also have to know who I am not. So when there is a solution, it talks about the moderate eater and the heavy eater. Okay, so the moderate eater is someone who can take it or leave it alone. So my father is the moderate eater. My father, when he goes on vacation, what he does is he weighs himself before he leaves. Imbibing in the local cuisine is one of the favorite things he does when he goes on vacation. He comes back, he weighs himself, sees he gains, like, sometimes he'll gain 10 pounds in a week. And then he simply curtails his eating, takes off the cup and 10 pounds in a few weeks, and goes back to his normal routine. That's a moderate eater. That's the people that on Halloween in your office are eating all the leftover candy, saying, I can't believe I'm doing this. But then 3 days later, the rest of the candy is sitting on their desk because they don't want any more of it. That's a moderate eater. Then there's the heavy eater. That's someone who might look like us, but given sufficient reason, they can stop or moderate. So I'm going to use myself as an example. As far as an alcoholic is concerned, I never drank until I went to college, drank straight through from 18 to 27. I mean, I drank and drove so many times. If I had been caught one of the many times that I drank and drove, I would have been sentenced to AA. And I would have gone to AA, and they would have told me, don't drink and go to meetings, and I would have been fine. Because I had the ability to choose not to drink, and that's what happened to me. I was in a car, drove the wrong way down a highway, almost killed me and my friends, scared myself to death, didn't drink again for 6 years, decided to have a beer and thought, I don't like the taste of beer because I don't have the allergy. I just wanted to get drunk because I was so insecure as a college kid. So I don't need a 12-step program when it comes to alcohol, even though I could probably get up at an AA meeting and talk a lot of the stories that AA people did, because I had a lot of the consequences of alcohol. But I'm not an alcoholic. So the danger in an Overeaters Anonymous meeting is the heavy eater that gets up in front of a room who can say, don't drink and go to meetings, and they mean it because that is their personal experience. That is their personal truth. because they don't need the 12 steps. And they're welcome here because our third tradition says if you want to call yourself a member, you can call yourself a member. Doesn't mean you're a compulsive overeater. It means you're a member. But the danger is if someone who can stay abstinent and happy on don't eat and go to meetings is going to kill someone like me. Because I'm incapable of not eating and going to meetings. I'm incapable of working the tools only and staying abstinent and happy. I needed these 12 steps. So the difference for me those first 17 years was using OA as a diet club with group support. And the last 4 years is actually being in a 12-step program, working the 12 steps. And let me tell you, for those of you who are like bristling in your panties about the tools, is I work the tools harder today by not working the tools. Because what the tools were for me was a checkoff list, 3 meetings. And I did them, and I crocheted through a lot of them, didn't pay a darn bit of attention. I would go 5 minutes late and leave 5 minutes early, but I fulfilled my requirement of 3 meetings. I now today attend 5 phone meetings a week, 2 OA meetings, and an AA meeting, not being an alcoholic, because I need to hear this message. I used to make 3 phone calls a day. Hi, making my outreach call. Thanks for being number one. Hi, making my outreach call. Thanks for being number two. I talk to 10, 15 people a day. And I talk to people that are in, you know, working these steps. I talk about the program of recovery. You know, I sponsored in Overeaters Anonymous, and this is the irony, is what is the first 3 steps? I admit that my life is unmanageable and I'm powerless. I admit I need a higher power, and I step 3, decide I'm not going to be God anymore. And what did I do when I sponsored? I would try to manage your life, I would try to be your higher power, and I would tell you exactly what to do. So I could only sponsor 2 people. It's tough managing other people's lives. And I am 47 years old, I've never been married, don't have kids, and I can't even tell you how many people I told them who to date, leave their husbands, how to raise their children, why people listen to me, I had no freaking idea. Now, I usually have 4 to 5 girls actively in the work. They get through the steps, they start helping others, so I can sponsor 20 to 30 people at a time. Because, you know why? Because I'm not their higher power. My job as a sponsor is to get them in touch with a higher power that they can have their own lives. And the reason I say that, once again, like Barbara, if what you're doing is different, it's working for you, that's great. But I do want to tell you, this is soapbox minute, is we have such a low recovery rate. If everyone just sponsors 2 people, there's going to be so many people out there that need help. We have like a 5% recovery rate. We need people through these steps in the trenches, carrying this message, because we have the ability to avert misery and death by working these 12 steps. So I work these tools harder, once again, by not working the tools and instead working up a program of recovery, which, in order to support that program of recovery, I'm working the tools. So that's the difference between 17 years of recovering, where Kim was in control and Kim was going in and out of the food. And I don't even like to call it relapse and recovery, because there was no recovery. It was the progression of the illness, periods of sobriety followed by even worse periods of relapse. That's what I was experiencing. But once I had that psychic change 4 years ago, I live a life where I wake up in the day and I don't say, God, help me to be abstinent. I say, God, how can I be useful to you and my fellows? And my natural consequence is I am abstinent. My experience before that was white-knuckling it through the day, doing the tools, you know, just praying to God that I'll be a good little girl if you only reward me, and going to bed at night exhausted saying, thanks, I have for one more day of abstinence. When someone asks me how long I'm abstinent, you know, I have to think about it. If you asked me before, I could tell you down to the minute, because I felt every frickin' minute of it. When you are abstinent only, it's a long frickin' 24 hours. Because you know what that means? You have to be abstinent in the morning, you have to be abstinent in the afternoon, and you have to be abstinent at night. That's a long day if all you're doing is just trying to be abstinent. And that's not my goal. I used to say, I'm going to shut up with this. I used to say always, abstinence is the most important thing in my life today without exception. That's shortchanging us. Today, God, my relationship with my higher power is the most important thing in my life today without exception. And because of that, because I remain unblocked by working these 12 steps, natural byproduct is I am abstinent. And with that, we have 10 minutes of time for questions. You want to turn that off? Okay.
I'm just going to turn that off because